books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
We're back in Scotland's Book Town for more recorded at the Wigtown Book Festival. And today we're talking about Victorian medicine in Edinburgh and travelling the world looking for monsters.
All that and more on today's Read On, the audiobook show.
In a moment, travel writer Nicholas Jubber will take us to Monsterland. And later on in today's show, I'll chat to married couple Chris Brookmeyer and Marissa Hatesman, otherwise known as Ambrose Parry, about the latest Raven and Fisher mystery. Plus, we'll find some new books in the RNIB library. All coming up in today's Read On. Monsters, in all their terrifying glory, have preoccupied humans since we began telling stories. But where did these stories come from? In Monsterland, award-winning author Nicholas Jubber goes on a journey to discover more about the monsters we've invented, lurking in the dark and the wild places of the earth. Giants, dragons, ogres, zombies, ghosts, demons. All with one thing in common, their ability to terrify. His far-ranging adventure takes him across the world. He sits on the thrones of giants in Cornwall, visits the shrine of a beheaded ogre near Kyoto, travels to an 18th century Balkan vampire's forest dwelling, and paddles among the shapeshifters of the Louisiana bayous. On his travels, he discovers that the stories of the people and places that birthed them are just as fascinating as the creatures themselves. Nick was last on Read On with his book The Fairy Tellers, which he narrated himself. But this time around, the audio version of Monsterland is narrated by Charles Armstrong.
Snow was falling over the mountains. It shrouded the trees and hooded the rocks. It smeared the roofs in the village below and speckled the river like the spots on a wild beast's pelt. It was just the kind of weather you'd expect on the day when the monsters are coming. There they were, stomping down the stony, snow-laden path towards me. Some were fanned by feathers, others obscured by fleece. Under pinhole eyes rimmed with colour, bear-like snouts bulged and bony fangs curled out of mouths as red as the horns on their heads. Spring comes late to the Rodopi Mountains. The streets were still rinking, the low piles capped with snow. The monsters were better at negotiating the slopes than me, so I flatter myself against the stone walls of my host Ilya's house and watch them go by. Cowbells tinkled from their horns. Bronze clappers rattled on their knees, the sort of clanging you'd expect to hear if a metal gate had been flung open. We call them kukri. It goes back to the ancient Thracians. Ilya's eyes flashed in his broad, beaming face. Dionysus and all his parties. That's what it is. It's celebration. The kukri are about life. Behind him, a mask hung from a nail, over an old saddle and a woodpile. A beard of silky black goat hair spilled from a face tessellated with pieces of bone. Apotropaic, an image of evil warding off the evil outside. A lesson in the ambiguity of folk monsters and the stories we tell about them.
Well, it's the story of my journey around monsters around the world, across four continents and a dozen different countries, and it's exploring stories going back into ancient times right the way through into the 20th century and beyond, and looking at how stories of monsters have changed across the ages, but also how different monster stories are told in lots of different cultures around the world and what connections we can find between those stories. So it's a book about the connections between cultures and time, but also about the distinctiveness within them.
The square of Shiroka Laka was their destination, the heart of a Bulgarian mountain village. Count all the eyes fixed on the monsters, 1,000 and rising. The Kukeri swung around each other, leaped and tumbled. Like animals taking over the farm, they yoked themselves to a wooden plough and drove it around the square. Others held up a wooden spindle, a stump of wood painted red. Their name remains a mystery. Some derive it from kuka, Proto-Slavic for evil spirit, others from the Latin for hood. But the longer I watch them, the less they seem like evil spirits, more like distorted mirrors for humanity. Guided by their leader, who had antler-like horns and went by the tongue-twisting title of Bul-Yuk-Bashir, they were acting out a cosmic drama handed down from generation to generation. It plays out like some burlesque variation on a Greek tragedy. Over here, the Kukeri roll on the ground, conical hoods swaying like sheaves of corn in the breeze, a chorus in mime to the scattering of grain. This is Kukaroften, the day of the Kuka, a spell without words, dramatizing the cycle of life and death, rapture and pain. Of course it brings us together. This is the purpose. Late in the evening, one of the Kukeri faced me in the village bar. Poor man. He was having to field questions from the gangly, pasty-faced fellow from way out of town. With his mask on the table between us, he took a swig from a bottle of Kushovitse beer. It is in our blood. My father did it also, and my grandfather. The best thing is not what you can see. For us, it is the time we are practicing. What does it feel like, I asked, when you're in the mask, when you become a kuka, do you feel different? He shrugged, took a sip of his beer while I was rephrasing the question. But another kuka leaned across his shoulder. I know what you say. Something, when we put the mask on, something happens to us. In life, even when everything is... He screwed his fist together, showing how dark things can get. Still, when the mask is on, then we are... One hand grasped at the air, as if the word was hiding in the rafters, and his eyes lit up when he found it. Free.
So is there like a werewolf legend in various countries and, say, a vampire legend in various countries?
Well, yeah, vampires and werewolves are two monsters that crop up all over the place. I mean, we're talking here in Wigton, where there's the story of the vampire Annan from not very far from here, which was recorded by William of Newburgh in the 12th century, I think. So, yeah, vampire stories do crop up all over the place. With the vampire chapter, I focus specifically on the root of the word vampire, which comes from the Serbo-Croat. So I've gone to the Balkans there, and I spent a night in a vampire's haunted mill, which is supposed to be haunted by a vampire from the 18th century called Sava Savanovic, and talked to a lot of people there about some of the vampire stories that emerged, especially in the 17th and 18th century. It was said in the 1730s by Voltaire, the great French satirist, that nothing was spoken of more than vampires. So there were a huge number of stories that many people believed to be true that were emerging in that particular time. And throughout the book, I've sort of looked at particular moments in history where particular monsters have a sort of vogue. So it's vampires in the 18th century. With werewolves, it's France in the 1600s, when there was a sort of spate of stories about werewolves. There were people brought up before the high courts and in places like Bordeaux, accused of either being werewolves or behaving like them, and then getting locked up as being insane. So it was a time, it's often the case, I think, throughout history, that when there's a time of political turmoil and there's a lot of trouble going on, that people start accusing others of being monsters and witches and dabbling in demonic crafts. And we see that even today with some of the accusations that get slung at each other from different sides of political spectrums, and in some of the rhetoric that comes out of our present day war zones. So I think it's always there. But yeah, there are certain monsters that seem to really become really resonant at particular moments in history.
As far back as we can go, there they are, waiting for us. 40,000 years ago or so, a figure known today as the Löwenmensch, or Lion Man, was carved from a mammoth's tusk in the Swabian Jura, a bipedal theriomorph combining features of human and beast. In the oldest written tale, the 4,000-year-old Sumerian Epic of Gilgamesh, the eponymous hero confronts the forest guardian Humbaba the Terrible, a tusked giant born from a mountain, whose speech is fire, and his breath is death. The Bible tells of Behemoth, the chaos monster at the beginning of creation. Browse the pages of the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and you'll come across wrathful deities with the heads of wild beasts, garlands of snakes, and corpses over their shoulders, stirring the cycle of existence with their lion's manes and bulging eyes. The stories of the ancient world can be so boggy, with their arcane rites and auguries, baffling hierarchies, and obsession with honour. It's a challenge to find an accessible entry point. What guides us in, again and again, are the monsters. Odysseus and his crew trying not to get eaten by the Cyclops. The Hindu hero Rama and his monkey army battling demonic Rakshasas. The great northern strongman Beowulf ripping the clawed arm from the fen beast Grendel's shoulder. A few things may have changed over the millennia, but our fascination for monsters isn't one of them. What is different, however, is the way that we perceive the monsters. For the people who told those long-ago tales, they were more than mere fodder for heroic deeds. They were palpable threats to life, and even more worryingly, the afterlife, liable at any moment to tear through the flimsy barrier between our world and theirs.
Was there anything you discovered that was unique to one culture, like a monster you'd never heard of?
Well, Japan has a lot of monsters. I mean, they have an incredible sort of menagerie of monsters going back across centuries. So some of them were seemed very distinctive. You have the one of the monsters is it manifests as a sort of boy holding a piece of tofu and trying to sort of lure you in with the tofu. So that's one of their yokai, as they call them over there. So there were quite a few that came that I heard about there that I hadn't heard of before, and certainly, you know, really, you know, some of them, you know, very sort of mind-blowing. But also they have a lot of monsters that are very distinctive, like the Oni is the one that I focus on in Japan, which is a sort of horned, shape-shifting, flesh-eating monster. And they've been telling stories about Oni over more than 1,000 years. But it's very distinctively Japanese, but it also has things in common with sort of ogre-like creatures in many different cultures. And I'm often fascinated both by what makes these creatures distinctive and then also what connects them up with stories that are being told elsewhere.
And where you actually travel into these different locations?
Yes, I went to all the places that I wrote about. I felt that as a writer of sort of travel stroke history stroke folklore, that it's important to go to the places, but also because you get to meet people there. A lot of the book is about how communities gather around stories of monsters. So you have, for example, the Dragon of Bavaria, of a place called Furfenwald, which is a town that they call themselves the Drakenstadt, the town of the dragon, because they've had a dragon parade since at least 1590 AD and probably even further back than then. And it's been going on every year. They parade the dragon through the town, and then somebody from the town is chosen as the dragon slayer. And now it's the world's largest walking robot that's made for a huge amount of money by various special effects companies. The past, obviously, it was a bit simpler than that. But it brings people together. You have 1,000 people dressed up in medieval and ancient garb, and then you have huge crowds of people who come to see it, and it unites people. Same in with the Werewolf of Louisiana, which I researched about, the Rougarou. You have a festival there called the Rougarou Fest, and it's an area in the south of Louisiana where they've been going through a lot of difficulty with Hurricane Ida a couple of years ago, and the devastation from that, you know, huge number of people losing their homes or their homes being wrecked. So it doesn't compensate for that, but certainly having this festival, I think, was a way for a lot of people to sort of come together and to celebrate their sense of community.
Was there ever a point where you were scared?
Well, I spent a night in a vampire's mill in Serbia. So this is a place called Zorozhe, which is associated with the story of a vampire called Sava Savanovic. And the story is that he was a miller who was killed after murdering a woman that he was in love with, and then hidden away, and people forgot about him. They sort of buried him far from the village. And then the mill was haunted. People couldn't go and grind their flour, so they had to try and find out the name of the vampire, which they eventually did, and then they were able to slay him. So I thought that it would be interesting to spend the night in that mill, but because I hadn't reckoned for just how scary it would become, But that was the test, really. It was the challenge, because I didn't think I believed in vampires. But certainly spending the whole night in that little sort of creaky wooden mill over this beautiful gushing river. But, you know, everything gets rather sinister as dark takes over, and you can hear the nightjars chirring and the owls shrieking, and just wondering what is it that's making that noise up in the roof of the mill there. And it's amazing what it does to your imagination. So that was an exciting experience, and I think I was very, very grateful when the first glimmer of light appeared over the horizon, and I took that as a sign that my night was over and I could now leave. I think it was about 4:30 in the morning at that point. I was like, yeah, that's it, I'm done. But then actually what I hadn't accounted for was the possibility of dogs, which they're then barking at me all the way as I made my way back to the main road to get the one daily bus back to Belgrade. And I think the barking of the dogs was almost as scary as what I was imagining inside the mill.
With the age of science, the traditional monsters found themselves against an insuperable barrier, dismissed from reality and excluded from scientific taxonomies. They were confined to the zone of storytelling, glamorous afterimages of dying or disempowered cultures. As we shall see, some of the most powerful manifestations of monsters exist in this limbo state, representing historical memories of times long past, emotional connections with periods of seismic change and traumatic loss. But the world keeps turning, and in the industrialized world, a new perception of monsters emerged. In a world less and less convinced of their existence, they became monetized spectacles, marshalled for a rapidly increasing range of mass media. From macabre bloodsuckers in penny dreadfuls to stop-motion, rubber-suited, or latterly CGI movie behemoths, monsters have taken pride of place in commercial storytelling.
Now, we heard clips of Charles Armstrong reading the book. Were you responsible in any way for his casting?
I mean, I was given a veto. That was, I think that was all really.
Do you not fancy doing it yourself?
I do, yeah. I did my last book, actually. But I think, you know, sometimes you get the opportunity and sometimes you don't. It just depends on circumstances.
Now, one thing we'll miss if we download the book from an online source is the cover. Can you give us a little description of the cover of Monsterland?
Oh, I think it's a beautiful cover. It combines a variety of different imagery of sort of all, I think all of the monsters in the book are included in it. It's got the vampire, the ogre, the oni, the selkies, who a little bit of Scottish mythology in the book, and many others. So it's really beautifully designed.
Did you come away with a favourite monster?
I've always loved dragons for their sort of splendour, their combination of different elements, their ability to breathe fire, but also to fly, and their sort of the scale. And I think I grew up loving a lot of dragon stories like The Hobbit and so on. So I think they've always been quite a favourite. But I think that in the course of writing and researching the book, I found myself drawn to each of the monsters in turn. Certainly very intrigued by vampires, although I've always found them quite creepy. I grew to love Godzilla, the Japanese film monster who featured in, I think, more movies than any other franchise monster, and is an extraordinary, both an extraordinary creation visually, but also an extraordinary representation of Japanese history and culture. So, yeah, there's a sort of, I think that in the course of doing the book, there's become a little part of my heart for each of them.
This doesn't mean the old fears have been fully suppressed, or at least in being suppressed, they still have a knack for finding outlets. In an irony that says much about the twisty path of the monster story, science, which had done so much to smother the old beliefs, became the most fertile source of our modern fears and inspiration for new hordes. Now, instead of being spawned by gods or magic spells, monsters draw their power from electrolysis, poisonous chemicals, neutron radiation, fossil fuel extraction, cloning technology. Or they travel across the stars, alerted to our planet by the signals we're relentlessly broadcasting. Punishments for human hubris, these new monsters transform our scientific achievements into visions of the apocalypse that will eventually engulf us.
Monsterland, a journey around the world's dark imagination, written by Nicholas Jobber and narrated by Charles Armstrong, is available now from wherever you buy your audiobooks.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
And we'll have more from Nicholas Jubber later in today's show in Books of My Life. And next, let's travel to the RNIB library with Lynn Livingston to find some brand new books.
Thanks to the kind donations from many of UK's audio publishers, it can be hard to keep up with all the great new books entering the Talking Books library. So here are two new gems.
The Two Roberts by Damien Barr was donated by Canongate. It is based on a true story.
From up here, their childhood spread before them in fields of blue reaching barley, rolling right up to the gates of the dark factories, still just about making everything an empire could need. Salt dries the air. The distant sea is dancing sun pennies. Great ships greet one another coming and going from the Clyde. From up here, Bobby and Robert can see the whole world, but it can't see them. Bobby feels the unlikely sun butter his body. He will stay like this forever. Robert's arm draped round him. They will be forever 20. He tries to look up at the sky without shifting, senses any movement could end this moment. He picks shapes out of the clouds, never in shortage over Ayrshire, even on this endless, impossible afternoon.
"Rabbit," says Bobby, still catching his breath. "See? See, it's ears." "Robert."
Silence.
Scotland, 1933. Bobby McBride is on his way. After years grafting at Lee's Boot Factory, he's off to the Glasgow School of Art, to his future. On his first day, he will meet another Robert, a quiet man with loose dark curls, and never leave his side. Together they will spend every penny and every minute devouring Glasgow, its botanical gardens, the Barrows Market, a whole hidden city, all the while loving each other behind closed doors. With the world on the brink of war, their unrivalled talent will take them to Paris, Rome, London. They will become stars as the bombs fall, hosting wild parties with the likes of Lucian Freud, Francis Bacon and Elizabeth Smart. But the brightest stars burn fastest. Stunningly reimagined, The Two Roberts is a profoundly moving story of devotion and obsession, art and class. It is a love letter to McBride and Colquhoun, the almost forgotten artists who try to change the way the world sees, and paid a devastating price.
The high blue wind, which wouldn't dream of ruffling a hair on either head, sets the cloud rabbit running. Bobby puffs his licorice black fringe off his eyes and squints up.
"He's on his back legs now. Look, he's at the dancing."
Silence still. A skylark peels straight up, close enough to nearly catch, spilling its song over the pair of them. A blessing, thinks Bobby. A witness, thinks Robert, reclaiming his arm and turning away. Bobby rolls over to Robert and his accusing back.
"Robert Colquhoun, are you listening to me?"
Bobby takes this opportunity to observe Robert. He's not stopped looking since clocking him on their first day. Never imagined another man would let him look, never mind look back. Already, their first year at the art school is over. Their lease is over, and they cannot afford this unimagined summer. They are being split up. It is unbearable. It is unstoppable.
"Robert! Robert! Have you died?"
Robert screws his eyes shut, hoping Bobby will get the idea for once. But the June sky won't be ignored, and neither will Bobby. It is, unbelievably, too hot. Like a hound waking, Robert stretches his long, pale legs, ploughing his heels into the rich black soil, then crumbling it between his toes to make his point.
The Two Roberts by Damien Barr is read by Michael Abubakar and runs for 11 hours and 39 minutes.
Boudicca's Daughter by Elodie Harper was donated by Bloomsbury.
The twisted branches flash past, swift as shadows, yet solid as spears. I don't have time to feel afraid of falling or being struck by deadly low-hanging trees. Instead, I cling to Tan's mane, my heartbeat racing to the thunder of his footfall. A horse gallops faster than thought, and nothing exists for me but the exhilaration of his speed. The force of it hits me like fire, filling me with joy. Around us, the wild wood, stripped of its leaves, glows green from the moss, which rolls over waves of roots and stone in a luminous sea. Then Belenia's scream rings out, startling Tan, sending the last of the birds scattering. I turn in the direction of her cry. My sister has managed to overtake me, weaving dangerously through a narrow gap in the woods, more reckless than I would ever dare to be. Before I can urge Tan to go faster, Belenia's horse Kintu shoots into the path in front, kicking up clods of earth, blackening the way. I don't have the guts to try and shoulder her aside. Either of us could be snared in a savage tangle of roots and whip-like boughs. Anger fills my heart as my vision shrinks to Kintu's powerful haunches, the dark rope of his tail, the gold of my sister's blonde hair.
Boudica, infamous warrior, queen of the British Iceni tribe, a mastermind of one of history's greatest revolts. Her defeat spelled ruin for her people, yet still her name is enough to strike fear into Roman hearts. But what of the woman who grew up in her shadow? The woman who has her mother's looks and cunning, but a spirit all of her own. The woman whose desperate bid for survival will take her from Britain's sacred marshlands to the glittering facades of Nero's Roman Empire. Born to a legend, forced to fight, determined to succeed. Meet Selina, Boudica's daughter.
White sky burned through the thinning trees, the green glow fading. Then we burst out onto the plain. Open space excites Tan, giving him another burst of speed. Belenia is ahead, but not out of reach. I shout at my horse, encouraging him to gallop faster. But Kintu is still swifter, and the two waiting figures grow more solid in the distance. Beyond them, the target also looms, the curved husk of a wide, blackened log, upended in the boggy ground. A dark imitation of a Roman invader. I see Belenia hold out her spear poised, an image of grace before she throws. Iron sinks into bark, and she wheels off screaming in triumph. I raise my own arm, bracing against the weight of the weapon, urging Tan to gallop directly at the target. He shears off at the last minute, but I ride him so close I hit the chalk daubed at its heart. Unlike my sister, I canter towards Riamanda and our mother in silence. They sit tall on their horses, watching. Tan's breathing is heavy, sweat lathered into foam at his sides, his coat drenched. Belenia is already dismounted, weapon drawn, leaving Kintu untethered, the horse's sides heaving like bellows. I leave Tan, drawing the weighted wooden sword from my back. Not a real weapon, but still banned. Still reason enough to train out here, where the grey fingers of the sea reach into the land and no spies will watch us.
Boudica's Daughter by Elodie Harper is read by Natalie Emmanuel, with an introduction read by the author, and runs for 14 hours and 52 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com. or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB Library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles, which readers can access on CD, on USB, or as a digital download. The RNIB Library also caters for adults and children in Braille so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB Library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
Escape into the world of great literature with Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio. Every weekday at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m, hear from a complete unabridged classic from the RNIB library, beautifully narrated and specially selected for blind and partially sighted listeners. From timeless adventures to literary masterpieces, these serialised audiobooks let you enjoy a new chapter every day. And for younger listeners, don't miss Children's Talking Books every Saturday at 9 a.m. Perfect for the young at heart, and for sparking imaginations. Talking Books, every weekday at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m, only on RNIB Connect Radio. At the Wigtown Book Festival, I spoke to the two-headed author, Ambrose Parry, a pseudonym for a collaboration between husband and wife, Chris Brookmeyer and Marissa Hetzman, who were at Wigtown to discuss The Death of Shame, the latest Raven and Fisher mystery. I also chatted to Chris about the upcoming 30th anniversary of the first appearance of his character, Jack Parlabane, and the brand new adventure, Quite Ugly One Evening, which is coming next year. The Death of Shame, as with all of the Ambrose Parry books, is narrated by Brian Dick and Kathleen McCarran.
There was a crowd like an execution at Queen Street, Miss Poole said as she took a seat. The butler mentioned that you had a surgery here. I wasn't too sure, but I'm pressed for time and I didn't want to wait. Raven tried not to take offence. Given that this was currently his only patient, it was a luxury he could not afford. Unfortunately, Miss Poole was possibly the last person he wanted to see. She had plagued him at Queen Street and kept returning to see him, even though she maintained that whatever he recommended or prescribed was completely useless. She had a long list of symptoms that seemed to grow rather than shrink, and always had new complaints that tended to reflect whatever she had most recently read about in the newspapers. Raven often thought it was as well she did not have easy access to medical journals or the meetings of the Medical Chirurgical Society, as then who knew what exotic ailments she might decide she was suffering from. The cholera outbreak the previous year had seen her almost permanently stationed at Queen Street, her head swaddled in silk scarves in an attempt to keep the pestilence at bay. Raven had suggested that perhaps Dr. Simpson's waiting room was not the best place to be if one was keen to avoid contagion, but that had only kept her away for a week or so, before she returned with a cornucopia of vague and unusual symptoms. He had tried everything. Tonics, aperients, simple diet, fresh air. A walk in Princess Street Gardens was Dr. Simpson's preferred treatment for hypochondriasis, but all to no avail. She turned up regular as clockwork, ready to be disappointed in him all over again. In his kinder moments, Raven felt sorry for her, and now, given the lack of anything better to do, he sat back in his chair and decided to humour her. Simpson often said that a listening ear could be a potent treatment in itself.
Terrible business on Princess Street this morning, Miss Poole said.
What's that?
Seems some poor soul threw himself off the Scott Monument.
I think I know how he feels, Raven muttered. He risked a glance at Sarah, who was stocking up a cupboard at the far end of the room, and saw her stifle a laugh.
You mustn't joke about these things, Dr. Raven, Mrs. Poole chided. What would drive a man to do something like that?
Come back in another few weeks and I might have an answer for you.
Raven cast an eye over the policeman standing at his front door. He did not appear to be in any way injured or conspicuously unwell, though he did seem a bit pallid for someone otherwise so physically hale. Officer Caldwell, the man said nervously, as though trying to convince himself of his own name. He looked young to be in the job, but otherwise built for it, tall and strapping, suggesting he'd been reared on a farm rather than fighting for scraps in the old town. He reminded Raven of a few of the boys he had known at Heriot's, the type Raven could seldom resist getting into a tussle with. They had enjoyed throwing their weight about, and he had enjoyed conveying that they would not do so with impunity.
"Are you Will Raven?" the lad asked.
"Dr. Raven," he clarified, suppressing annoyance. Upon closer inspection, the policeman really did look paler than was surely natural, as though profoundly anxious or recently shocked.
"Sorry, sir. I've been sent by Mr. McCleavy."
"Is he ill?" Raven asked optimistically.
"No, he wishes your assistance. I've to escort you to Princes Street Gardens."
Our protagonist, Will Raven, has set up on his own now as a doctor. And he's not getting a lot of patients because he's finding it difficult to attract patients. So he's not in a position to say no when Inspector McCleavy asks him to come along and help identify a body of someone who's taken a header off the Scott Monument. It's someone quite prominent, and he's asked to investigate whether this was suicide, and if it wasn't, or if it was suicide, what drove this man to take his own life. So given it's called The Death of Shame, it's about blackmail and sexual hypocrisy in Victorian Edinburgh.
Raven's instinct was to say he was indisposed and not about to be escorted anywhere. He did not like anyone assuming he was at their beck and call, least of all the snarling Irish detective.
"Someone has fallen from the Scott Monument," the policeman added, perhaps sensing Raven's ambivalence.
"So I heard. Much as I'm flattered by Mr. McCleavy's estimation of my abilities, I don't imagine there's much I can do for the victim."
"No,"
Caldwell agreed. The lad shuddered, becoming even paler, and put his hand on the railing to steady himself. Raven feared he might vomit, but the moment passed. No need to ask if he had seen the remains.
"How does Mr. McCleavy think I can assist then?"
"He didn't say. He just told me to fetch you. I think he's maybe hoping you can help identify the man."
What drew you to combine your medical historian work with fiction?
Well, I think, obviously, I spent a lot of time reading a lot of historical non-fiction. And I think I had a notion of perhaps writing something myself. But then when we talked about it, Chris said that fiction, I think we were quite convinced that fiction is a better way of exploring some of the themes we were interested in. Mm-hmm. So you're not too hidebound by having to stick so rigidly to historical facts, and you were always of the opinion that it can make it a much more exciting story if you create your own characters and put them in that kind of environment.
More accessible, because Marissa had done her degree in the history of medicine and was toying with doing a PhD, and I said, well, about five people read a PhD, but if we write a novel together, an awful lot more people will learn about Simpson and his world, you know, because we were both aware that James Young Simpson wasn't as well known as he really should be in terms of his legacy. And I think that's been one of the benefits of the novels, is that he is better known, because if you put his story into a piece of popular culture, it becomes more digestible and so people take an interest.
If you could go back to 19th century Edinburgh for research, would you?
For a very brief period, as long as I could get back again, because life was kind of difficult for most people. I think the smells would probably knock you over. But if I could attend one of James Young Simpson's dinner parties, it would totally be worthwhile, especially if they were doing a bit of ether and chloroform sniffing after dinner.
Raven recalled Dr. Simpson telling him it was wise to have a man such as McCleavy owing you favours. But in practice, such wisdom only applied if you were as esteemed as the professor. Over the years, Raven recalled doing McCleavy a great many favours. Often, one might even say, doing his job for him. But as far as McCleavy was concerned, Raven's account was never in credit. Nonetheless, there was an enduring wisdom in not poking a bear. And Raven did not wish to give the Irishman any reason to add to his debit column. Let me get my coat.
Did you have any hand in the casting of the characters in the book?
Yeah, no, we didn't really. I think we were sent some samples. I can't actually remember, but we didn't really get involved that much. No. So we can't take any credit for the fact that everyone says they're fantastic.
Now, one thing we'll miss if we download the book from the RNIB library is the cover. Can you give us a wee description of the cover of the book?
For The Death of Shame, I think it's probably your favourite cover. Mm. Because it's about sexual hypocrisy and the fact that women are always blamed for everything. The front cover is an apple with a snake round it. And I think the snake is really important because it kind of refers to the Garden of Eden and Eve tempting Adam. But also the snake is very important as a symbol in medicine. So I think it's a lovely cover.
He stepped back inside the door. Sarah was waiting in the hall just outside his consulting room, while Eugenie had come to the head of the stairs to investigate what was happening. He could hear Clara fussing, an unquiet overture to a coming storm. One he had just been given the opportunity to escape. "The police require my assistance," he said. He tried not to meet his wife's gaze as he lifted his coat from the hook, knowing there would be accusation and rebuke in it.
Brian Dick and Kathleen McCarran reading from The Death of Shame by Chris Brookmeyer and Marissa Hatesman, a.k.a. Ambrose Parry. While I was talking to Chris, I couldn't not mention the fact that it's been 30 years since this.
Parley Bane came round slowly, his senses kicking in one at a time behind the steady, rhythmic throb of his headache, which for a few moments he had thought might be someone playing ambient trance through the wall. Pound, 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 pound. Different day, different city, same hangover. Like a fortune teller in reverse, he struggled to peer through the haze and see what lay in his immediate past. At first he couldn't remember much, but was sure that the number 80 had been somehow very significant. Then the smell hit him and spun him into an accelerating panic. He sat up rapidly and winced as his sudden movement brought a cymbal crash to the end of a bar in his head. That smell was miserably familiar and quite unmistakable. 100% recycled materials. For best results, shake well before opening. He felt a draft and saw that the window was open, which snapped a piece of the puzzle into place, but suggested the completed picture would not be pretty. He remembered getting up and opening it at some point during the night to let the smell out, and figured he must have spewed but been too incapacitated to clear it up at the time. The source of his panic was that he couldn't remember where he had thrown up. Indeed, he couldn't recall the act at all, but was certain it couldn't have been anywhere sensible, because even an unflushed lavy bowl of bulk can't permeate a flat so comprehensively. Indeed, the smell was even stronger than before he had attempted to ventilate the place. He quickly turned to face the other way, expecting to find a lumpy abstract etched on one side of the pillow, but it was clean. He whipped the duvet off, but there was no multicoloured surprise waiting beneath. Where the hell was it? Pukey, come home.
Now, one thing that I'm looking forward to, but it's also a bit depressing, is that it's now 30 years of Jack Parley Bane, and there's a new Parley Bane on its way. Tell us about Quite Ugly One Evening.
It's a locked room murder mystery set on board a transatlantic liner. I hesitate to say cruise ship because we were on the Queen Mary 2 last year and they kept telling us it's not a cruise ship, it's a liner. And it's a kind of satire on the culture wars because there's a convention taking place on board to do with a 1960s puppet show, which is, for complex reasons, despite being a Daft Kids puppet show, has found itself at the heart of the culture wars in the 21st century. So it's a bit of social and political satire, but it's also delving into Parley Bane's family background for the first time, which I've never really explored that side of him, and him coming to terms with middle age.
Quite Ugly One Evening by Christopher Brookmeyer will be out in May of 2026, and The Death of Shame by Ambrose Parry is available in audio now and has joined all the other Ambrose Parry books and indeed Chris Brookmeyer books in the RNIB library.
This is an RNIB talking book.
Talking books are wonderful. They enable people who can't read anymore to join in with the rest of the world and be a part of the world. I think they're excellent. I enjoy biography, I enjoy travel, I enjoy classics, I enjoy a good tale. With some of the readers, there is a problem that you can go to sleep in the middle when you get to my age.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
And finally on today's show, a return to Nicholas Jubber for The Books of My Life.
Is there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading?
Yeah, there were many books, but I think that The Hobbit is certainly one of them. I mean, my love of monsters, one of the things that triggered it was watching and then reading the novelizations of Doctor Who, which used to be a great favourite of mine as a child. So a lot of those novelizations, which each would have their own different monster, would always really fascinate me and were probably responsible for developing my vocabulary more than anything else that I read.
When Sarah came down from her room, Unit Temporary HQ was empty, except for the doctor. He was happily fiddling with a pile of electronic equipment, which he had spread all over the big table. Sarah peered over his shoulder. "What's all this, then?" The doctor sighed. Sarah's constant curiosity about anything and everything was one of her most engaging characteristics, but it could get a little wearing. He knew from experience it was no good trying to put her off. Only a clear, precise explanation would satisfy that inquiring journalistic mind. He spoke without looking up from his work.
"This is part of a probe system for detecting localized jamming and alien energy emissions."
Sarah considered for a moment and said, "What happens if whatever's doing the jamming jams the jamming detector?" The doctor opened his mouth to deliver a crushing reply, then realized with a shock that Sarah was quite right. He'd overlooked that problem.
"I shall build in a protective circuit," he said with dignity, hurriedly assembling the necessary parts.
Sarah started wandering round the room. She wanted to tell the doctor about her chats with Angus and the villagers, but he was obviously too preoccupied to listen. She glanced up, met the baleful glare of the stag's head, and hurriedly looked away.
"Where's the brigadier?" "Down at the quayside, I think. They're bringing in some wreckage from one of the rigs. I asked him to get the stuff to me here before too many people know about it."
"No use trying to be secretive in this village," said Sarah darkly. "The landlord's got the second sight." The doctor made a minute adjustment to a very small circuit.
"Maybe we should recruit him into unit."
The telephone rang, and Sarah picked it up. It was the brigadier, and his news made Sarah go pale with shock. She said,
"Yes, he's here, I'll tell him. We'll come at once."
Something in her voice made the doctor look up.
"What is it, Sarah? Bad news?"
Sarah nodded.
"It's Harry. He's been shot."
The hidden control room was filled with a strange sound. It was a high-pitched electronic gurgling, rhythmic and monotonous. The creature, the console, reached out, touched one of the nodules on the control panel, and the noise went up in pitch. The control console, and indeed the entire control room, was as peculiar and alien in shape as the creatures operating it. It was made of a strange, gnarled, fibrous material, and somehow seemed to have been grown rather than constructed. Instead of knobs and levers, there were root-like stumps and projections, while sensitive nodules replaced buttons and switches. The alien being at the console was a Zygon. Its name was Broton, and its voice when it spoke had a hissing, gurgling quality, curiously like the noise that filled the air.
"What is the impulse strength?"
On the other side of the control room, another Zygon presided over a similar bank of root-like instruments. It replied in the same hissing, gurgling tones.
"Diastolic reading 703.
That's John Culshaw reading from Doctor Who and the Loch Ness Monster by Terence Dix. And then Gabriel Wolfe, voice of Sutek himself, reading from a classic recording of Doctor Who and the Loch Ness Monster, one of many Doctor Who novelisations, both old and new, available from RNIB Library, as of course is The Hobbit.
Is there a book on a rainy day you could happily curl up with and reread?
Well, yes, but on a rainy day, I always want to read something new, something that I haven't read before. But yeah, I mean, I have my sort of old favourites. I love some of the 19th century classics. You know, I'd probably, I'd always be able to curl up with something like a David Copperfield or a Jane Eyre or Wuthering Heights. But some of my favourites for books for curling up, with, I think, the Neapolitan Quartet by Elena Ferrante, the Cairo Trilogy by Dan Grubb Mahfouz. Yeah, those are all books that I could read and reread endlessly.
This morning, Reno telephoned. I thought he wanted money again, and I was ready to say no. But that was not the reason for the phone call. His mother was gone. Since when? Since 2 weeks ago. And you're calling me now? My tone must have seemed hostile, even though I wasn't angry or offended. There was just a touch of sarcasm. He tried to respond, but he did so in an awkward, muddled way, half in dialect, half in Italian. He said he was sure that his mother was wandering around Naples as usual. Even at night? You know how she is. I do, but does 2 weeks of absence seem normal? Yes. You haven't seen her for a while, Elena. She's gotten worse. She's never sleepy. She comes in, goes out, does what she likes. Anyway, in the end, he had started to get worried. He had asked everyone, made the rounds of the hospitals. He'd even gone to the police. Nothing. His mother wasn't anywhere. What a good son. A large man, 40 years old, who hadn't worked in his life, just a small-time crook and spendthrift. I could imagine how carefully he had done his searching. Not at all. He had no brain, and in his heart he had only himself. "She's not with you," he asked suddenly. "His mother? Here in Turin?" He knew the situation perfectly well. He was speaking only to speak. Yes, he liked to travel. He had come to my house at least a dozen times without being invited. His mother, whom I would have welcomed with pleasure, had never left Naples in her life. I answered, "No, she's not with me." "You're sure?" "Reno, please. I told you she's not here." "Then where has she gone?" He began to cry, and I let him act out his desperation. Sobs that began fake and became real. When he stopped, I said, "Please, for once behave as she would like. Don't look for her."
"What do you mean?"
"Just what I said. It's pointless. Learn to stand on your own 2 feet and don't call me again either." I hung up.
Madeline Brawley reading from My Brilliant Friend, book one in the Neapolitan series by Elena Ferrante, which is available from RNIB.
And is there a book, finally, is there a book you've read recently, it's fresh in the mind, you'd like to recommend?
Yes, Days Without End by Sebastian Barry. I read quite recently and I found that beautifully lyrical and atmospheric and a wonderful sort of depiction of a few unlikely characters during quite a long period of American history, actually, but centering around the American Civil War.
The method of laying out a corpse in Missouri sure took the proverbial cake. Like decking out our poor lost troopers for marriage rather than death. All their uniforms brushed down with lamp oil into a state never seen when they were alive. Their faces clean shaved, as if the embalmer sure didn't like no whiskers showing. No one that knew him could have recognised Trooper Watchhorn, because those famous Dundrearys was gone. Anyway, death likes to make a stranger of your face. True enough, their boxes weren't but cheap wood, but that was not the point. You lift one of those boxes and the body makes a big sag in it. Wood cut so thin at the mill, it was more a wafer than a plank. But dead boys don't mind things like that. The point was, we were glad to see them so well turned out, considering. I am talking now about the finale of my first engagement in the business of war. 1851 it was, most likely. Since the bloom was gone off me, I had volunteered age 17 in Missouri. If you had all your limbs, they took you. If you were a one-eyed boy, they might take you too, even so. The only pay worse than the worst pay in America was army pay. But you were glad to get work, because if you didn't work for the few dollars in America, you hungered. I had learned that lesson. Well, I was sick of hungering. Believe me when I say there is a certain type of man loves soldiering, no matter how mean the pay. First thing, you got a horse. He might be a spavined nag. He might be plagued by colic. He might show a goiter in his neck the size of a globe. But he was a horse. Second place, you got a uniform. It might have certain shortcomings in the stitching department, but it was a uniform, blue as a blue bottle's hide. Swear to God, army was a good life. I was 17 or thereabouts beginning. I could not say for certain. I will not say the years going up to my army days was easy. But all that dancing put muscle on me, in a wiry sort of way. I'm not speaking against my customers. I'm speaking for them. If you pay a dollar for a dance, you like a good few sweeps of the floor for that, God knows. Yes, the army took me, I'm proud to say.
Days Without End by Sebastian Barry is available from RNIB in Braille and in audio, as read by Aidan Kelly. And thanks once again to author of Monsterland, Nicholas Jobber. Every episode of Read On is available to download as a podcast. Just search for RNIB Read On in your favourite podcast app. Or tune in to our sister show every weekday at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. where we serialise one of the best books from the RNIB Talking Books collection that were allowed to play on air. For more information on the station, just search for RNIB Connect Radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.